Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures of the characters, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content that may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. The boss was walking back from the mailroom and was holding a stack of letters all bundled up together. Flipping through them, seeing the many names on the letters, he seemed to be looking for a specific name or address. His concentration was broken when he saw Rosie approaching him. "Rosie?" the boss said after looking up for a few seconds.
"Boss, we got letters in today?" Rosie asked.
"Yeah."
"Good,"
Rosie said as he started walking towards the mail hut before the boss stopped him.
"Wait, are you going there now?"
the boss asked.
"Yeah,"
Rosie responded.
"Good, I'll come with."
The two men began walking for some time before Rosie asked him,
"What are you going back for?"
"I don't know, just taking a walk." Rosie looked over at the boss and could see that he looked nervous and worried.
"Are you worried about Jack?" Rosie asked.
"What?
No,
he'll be fine," the boss shrugged off.
"From what I heard, it was a tough mission,"
Rosie prodded, trying to get the boss to say what Rosie thought he was really bothered about.
"Not as tough as Berlin. Besides, the Bremen force was expected to get more pushback."
"But you know nothing ever goes according to plan," Rosie fired.
"What are you doing?"
the boss asked as he stopped walking and faced Rosie.
"What do you mean?"
Rosie asked.
"You know what I'm talking about. You're prodding," the boss accused.
"No, I'm not. I'm asking simple questions and making simple statements," responded Rosie.
"Yeah, okay," the boss shot back before he began walking again.
"So you're not worried at all?
You're completely fine,"
Rosie asked with a grin on his face.
"Okay, well, since you're not going to cut the shit, I'll just go ahead and tell you. I'm thinking about getting Jack transferred to a different crew, but I was going to wait until after today's mission to make my final decision."
Rosie was rocked by the revelation. His feet stopped moving. His brow was raised towards the boss. The boss stopped walking and faced Rosie and was surprised by his look of shock.
"What?"
the boss asked.
"What on earth happened to you up there?" Rosie asked.
"What do you mean?"
"Ever since we came back from Berlin, you've been different."
"I have not. What are you talking about?" the boss asked.
"Yes, you have. You've been avoiding members of your own crew, and you made several negative comments about Skimpy and now about Jack," Rosie fired back.
"I have not been avoiding my crew. I've been around you and Jack every single day."
"Well, when was the last time that you paid Willie, Tommy, Skimpy, or the others a visit since we left the debriefing hut that day?"
the boss rolled his eyes and softly said,
"Don't get me started on Skimpy."
"When was the last time?" Rosie prodded some more. The boss overlooked Rosie's prodding and said,
"Rosie, you said yourself that Jack isn't cut for leading the crew on his own."
"I did. I didn't expect him to be. He's not our chief. You are," Rosie defended. The two began walking once more.
"Yes, but if something happens to me, he's not going to be able to lead the men. I need someone in the co-pilot seat who can take charge and someone who I know I can rely on if and when something happens to me."
"Okay, and what about Skimpy? What's wrong with him?"
"What isn't wrong with him? He's like a dog, scared of his own shadow. I gave him one job to do coming back from Berlin. He couldn't even do that."
"Boss, don't take this as I'm being disrespectful or being a contrarian as I normally am. But how do you figure Al was Skimpy's fault?"
Because
is not a good answer.
"Because I know that if he did his job like I told him, Al would still be alive," the boss fired.
The moment became pregnant with tension as Rosie pondered what the boss had just said.
"I'm sorry, what?"
Rosie finally asked.
"It's not that hard of a concept, Rosie. If Skimpy did his job, Al would still be alive."
"How the hell do you figure?" Rosie asked.
"I told him to keep watch over Al, to constantly check up on him. You know, keep his eyes glued to him."
"And you don't think he did that?"
Rosie asked. No. Why? Is he alive? Boss, you heard Skimpy tell you that he looked away for a split second and that he was gone when he looked back. Yeah, a split second can mean anything to Skimpy. He could have been spaced out or giving that blank stare that he was doing at the debriefing hut. Well, then you shouldn't have put him in that position, watching over him. Besides, judging by how much that kid wrote down in his notebook, he was more than likely overloaded because you told him that he had to write down every single detail. Overloaded. Listen to yourself. This is why you're just a bombardier and not the chief of your own crew. I don't know why I'm even wasting my time talking to you, the boss said, turning around and walking the opposite direction. Rosie waited for a few seconds, turned around, and then said to the boss, If you ask for them to be transferred and even get them grounded, I will go to a different crew and you'll have to find yourself a different bombardier, Rosie said, looking back at the boss. The boss, knowing it would be very difficult and almost impossible for Rosie to follow through with this, was still angered by Rosie's threat. He kept walking, his face bubbling with rage as he did. March 16th, 1944, United States Army Air Force Station 186, Thurlow, England, 1638. Anthony Palladino was walking down the dirt road that led through the winding roads of the enlisted men's barracks. The area he was walking through was known as Roosevelt Circle, and he was told that it had, up until about a week ago, been unused. The road looked for the most part to be maintained and cleaned up, but some of the huts looked rather unfinished and grimy. One hut that Anthony walked past hadn't been painted yet, and the corrugated curved pieces of metal had rust running down to the ground, and the hut was missing its door, revealing the empty cavity inside. For the most part, Thurlow looked new and well-kept, but this section stood out like a sore thumb. As Anthony Palladino walked, looking at different huts, with a few B-17s from the 530th Squadron parked at their hardstands off in the background, he began thinking about home. Home, for him, was half a world away, and he could feel every mile as he walked through the unfamiliar and strange world. He had grown up in Chicago, and the furthest he had ever traveled from home was to New York City when he was a kid, and that seemed like he went to a different planet. England was nothing like how his father described it. But then again, the last time his father had seen England, he was 19 years old, and the world looked a lot different in 1918. His father, Anthony Sr., had spent 2 days in Plymouth after the First World War was officially over. He described England as being smoke-filled, industrial, and a lot like downtown Detroit or New York City back home. This England, the one Anthony Jr. was experiencing, was more like Wisconsin, where his grandparents lived, full of farming fields, country roads, small villages, and sprawling pastures. 19-year-old Anthony Jr. was average height, standing at 5'7", and he was a solid 150 pounds. He played baseball at the YMCA and was exceptional among his peers, which made his father extremely proud. His father was a sports writer in Chicago and often took his son with him to White Sox games and Bears football games. Both father and son bonded profoundly over sports and still did. Oh, what Anthony would do to be at a White Sox game with his dad right about now. Approaching the hut he was told to report to, he looked down at his piece of paper that he had scrunched up in his hands. Adjusting the strap on his heavy green military bag that was pulling on his shoulder, he held up a piece of paper and saw that the hut number read, Hut 43. Looking up at the hut in front of him, the door on the side of the hut read, Hut 43. Knowing that this was the right one, Anthony took in a deep breath and proceeded to enter into it. The inside of the hut was brightly lit from the open windows at the top of the curved Quonset hut. Aligning the far side of the hut laid six beds, three on each end of the hut. A round wooden table with four chairs sat in the middle of the room, under a large window. To Anthony's left and right, along the wall next to him, were long metal poles in which the men hung their clothes from. Above the clothesline was a wooden shelf with two big windows. The room smelled of cigarette and cigar smoke, mixed with the smell of burning coal. Looking at the six beds, he saw only one man sitting in the hut. It was Beans.
"Well, howdy there, you lost?"
Beans asked Anthony. "I'm looking for Hut 43, Anthony responded.
"Oh yeah, this is it. What can I help you with?"
"I was told to report to Hut 43. I'm Sergeant Anthony Palladino, but my friends call me Pally. I just got in today," Anthony replied. As Bean stood over his bed, the reality of what was happening finally settled in. This kid was here to replace Al. The formation was flying 1,000 feet above the airfield, and on the ground, men were huddled all around the airfield, watching their friends return back from the mission. Over by the 530th Squadron hardstands, the boss and a group of other officers from the 530th were standing, waiting for their planes of their squadron to park themselves. The boss was still upset from his conversation that he had had with Rosie over an hour ago, and honestly was mad at himself that he didn't say something to Rosie after his threat. He tried to not focus on it, but instead made conversation with the men around him. The officer sitting next to him was Lieutenant Bill Rausch of Paper Doll and the newest member of the 530th Bombardment Group, and specifically the 530th Squadron, 2nd Lieutenant Shelby, from his plane, Bombshell Blondie, which was parked at its hard stand. Lieutenant Shelby was also from Youngstown, Ohio, and lived not too far away from where the boss was raised. They knew some of the same people and became very close. Looking over at Lieutenant Shelby's plane, he said, "That's a fine-looking plane you have over there, Shelby," the boss said. "I know. Isn't she? I'm honestly shocked by how sturdy she is compared to the older E-models they had us training with back in the States," Shelby commented. Shelby was average height, had short buzz-cut styled brown hair, a cleft chin, and bright green eyes. His uniform seemed to be swallowing him, he was so skinny. "Well, they had you practicing in E-models?" the boss asked Shelby.
"Yeah, they sent me up to some pilot training over in this new air base in Maine. We got there and the only B-17s they had were E-models and one F-model," Shelby explained.
"That's nothing. We did our practice missions in a C-model. That thing still had a bathtub gunner's position instead of a ball turret. It was so old," Rausch commented.
"Like the one in the movie Air Force?" Shelby asked.
"Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't able to go up against a fleet of Jap fighters, though. It was barely able to make it across the country. It had so many hours on it. They used the damn thing to do submarine patrols up and down the coast in 42. It was old," Rausch explained.
"Damn, it definitely had been around," the boss added in.
Just then, an officer with a pair of binoculars, who were standing behind them, called out,
"I count only five planes from the 530th.
The boss began counting the planes flying in the low squadron and couldn't tell which plane was what.
"Well, who's missing?" Rausch asked.
"Well, it looks like that new guy, Hillhouse. What was his plane's name? Deuces?"
the officer asked.
"Yeah, I think so," the boss commented.
"Well, if that's his plane's name, then he's not up there. I see Chief, Captain Kids, George Bell, that other new crew, Texas and Bob McGee, but no deuces.
The boss then looked up and was saddened for the possible loss of Hill House and his crew. If they were lost, then he felt bad for Benson, who would be told that his crew went down on their first mission without him. That's what happened to Mickey, and it broke him mentally. He hoped that Benson wouldn't be ruined by the news. But then again, the boss couldn't think of anyone else that would be better to replace Jack at the co-pilot seat. Benson was thick-skinned, easygoing, a strong presence among the men. He would make a great co-pilot, and the boss trusted him more than he trusted Jack. But then again, as the boss looked at Captain Kids, the crew that according to the flight sheet Jack was scheduled to fly with, he didn't know how Jack would react to being removed from the boss's crew. He knew that if he requested for Jack to be reassigned to a different crew, they would ask him why. The only thing that the boss could tell them that would deem necessary for a reassignment is if the boss told them that Jack was unfit for combat, in which they would have to give Jack an evaluation, along with Skimpy. He knew that if they weren't fit and weren't able to pass the mental exam, then they would get taken off of flight status. This didn't bother the boss, however, for if they were in fact unfit, then they had no business remaining in the boss's crew. If they passed, then they would just assign them to a rookie crew or an experienced one. As the boss pondered this some more, he saw the first bomber coming in to land. It was a B-17 from the 529 squadron. The bomber shot off a red flare, meaning it had wounded aboard. As the large bomber touched down on the east end of runway 4 and rolled into the grass where Chaplain Schwartz and the ambulance met them, the boss watched in a state of shock. Once he saw the red flare and the ambulance rushing to the bomber, he was reminded of his return from Berlin. He now felt what that pilot of that bomber was feeling, a rush of relief to finally be home, but also a pulsating feeling of despair. It was a feeling that nobody outside of a pilot seat of a flying fortress could understand. Soon, another B-17, this time from the 531st Squadron, landed on the east end of runway 3. Since this was closer to the boss, he was able to see the bomber closer and saw damage. Bullet holes riddled the waste compartment. More than likely, both waste gunners were hit and in serious condition. He watched the older F model with 22 yellow painted bombs pass by them and went off into the grass. Within a few seconds, it was revealed that it was in fact both waste gunners who needed medical attention. Then, the next plane to land was from Texas with Love. The B-17 had landed on the eastern end of runway 4, and the boss noticed that they did not shoot off a red flare. Minutes later, when Texas rolled down the perimeter track and went past the boss and the others, it was then that the boss's heart sank. The entire tail section was shot up. It looked just like how the tail of the bull looked when they came back from Berlin, and the image haunted the boss. Blood covered the gunner's window, and 3 large bullet holes were visible. As Texas rolled down to their hard stand, the boss and the others proceeded to run over to Texas and meet them just as their engines were cut. The first one out of the nose hatch was Texas's navigator, Cobb. He exited the bomber and landed on the concrete. His large shoulders were slumped down, and he looked utterly tired as he stood before the boss and a swarm of others around him. "Well, how bad was it?" asked one officer. Cobb moved out of the way so that his bombardier, Tim Shute, could get out of the nose. Looking up, he said, "I swear, the crossing over the Atlantic was faster." Tim Shute jumped down from the plane and was soon followed by Texas himself. Texas then explained to the men that on the return trip, they got jumped by 190s, when they were passing by the city of Kiel. That's when Texas informed the men that his tail gunner, 19-year-old Alonzo McFarlane from Roanoke, Virginia, was shot 3 times by a 190. He warned the officers that the scene was messy, but asked if anyone wanted to help him get his gunner out of the tail. The boss offered to help along with Cobb and Shute. As the boss helped the three officers take care of the gruesome and ghastly deed, that's when Texas mentioned to the boss that he was saddened to see Hill House and Jack fall out of formation. The boss stopped for a moment and said, Wait. Jack didn't fly with Hill House. He flew with Bernhausen. He was supposed to, but they switched with Merkel so he could fly with his crew. I could be wrong, but I saw him go into Hill House's plane. The boss looked up at the sky at Cap and kids coming in to land. Before the B-17 even made it back to their hard stand and cut their engines, the boss arrived at the nose hatch and called Jack's name. Bernhausen met the boss outside along with Merkel and their bombardier navigator. When the boss looked at Merkel, it was like he was seeing an illusion. "Where's Jack?" the boss asked. "He switched with me to fly with that rookie crew and they went down over the target," Merkel said. "Wait, they went down?" the boss asked. "Yeah, they took a hit to their number 4 engine and they fell away quickly. Didn't look good. We didn't see any parachutes," Bernhausen added. "But that doesn't mean that they went down, though. They could still be out there and on their way back like Bomb McGee did," the boss suggested with a sense of desperation in his voice. "It's unlikely for a rookie crew. And there were a lot of fighters in the area. Unless they were really far behind us and went a completely different route coming home, there's no way they didn't encounter fighters," explained Bernhausen, shooting down the boss's hopes. As the boss walked away from Cap and kids, he felt utterly crushed as a deep feeling of guilt washed over him. Then he thought about what Rosie would say once he found out that Jack was gone. Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, there's good news, because you can. You see, by visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free resources to help you know more about the 8th Air Force in World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. In fact, right now, you can take a virtual tour of 2 real B-17s like the ones depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, free YouTube videos, and so much more. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. Now, back to the podcast. Over at the control tower, Willie, Tommy, Skimpy, Beans, and their newest member of the crew, Pally, were watching planes return. Their eyes were glued to Georgia Bell, since they knew Mills was flying as a replacement gunner for them. They didn't know about Jack being missing. In fact, they didn't even know Jack was flying a mission today. Beans was eating some leftover rations from lunch, while explaining everything that was going on to Pally. Beans' loud chomping and talking with his mouth full was annoying Willie, who turned around and asked him, "Beans, could you chew any fucking louder? Especially with the new guy around." Beans proceeded to put another cracker in his mouth and began chewing even louder than before. "Nice. Nice, Beans. Thanks," Willie muttered as he looked back into the sky. "How many did we count?" Pally asked. 18 went out. "We only counted 17, Tommy said. 17? Was one of it ours?" Pally asked. "Yeah, I only counted 5 in the 530th, Tommy said, looking into the sky. "Wait, here comes Milch," Willie said as he looked to the eastern end of the airfield at Georgia Bell, which was coming into land on runway 4. However, something was noticeably wrong with how Georgia Bell was approaching the airfield. The B-17's landing gear never lowered as they came in closer and closer. "Where's their landing gear?" Pally asked. "Do you think they forgot it?" Skimpy asked. "No, trust me, you don't forget that," Willie replied, knowing all too well what it meant. No landing gear meant that the plane was heavily damaged and couldn't retract the landing gear down. A call must have come in, because fire trucks and ambulances were already heading in the direction of runway 4, even though no red flares were shot from Georgia Bell. The B-17 came down nice and easy, parallel to runway 4, on the left side, since there were no planes parked on that side. The B-17's underside made contact with the ground and everyone on base was shocked to see the large 30-ton fortress slide through the grass almost effortlessly. The only real damage that was done to the bomber was the ball turret, which was crushed on contact, along with the plane's propellers that were bent and broken off when they made contact with the grass. The B-17 came to a full stop, 200 yards away, and almost immediately, as soon as the plane came to a full stop, the fire engines arrived and began spraying the plane's engines with flame retardant in case a fire were to be ignited. The enlisted men of the Bull watched with suspense as they waited for Mills' face to emerge from the plane. One by one, Beans, Willie, Tommy, and Skimpy watched as a different crew member from Georgia Bell exited the plane from the waste compartment door, and finally, the last one to exit was Mills. With a deep sense of relief, the men all began clapping and cheering the crew as they walked over to where the men were all congregating. Soon after, Mills arrived with his crew members, holding all of his flight equipment in his bag. Mills removed his flight helmet to reveal his sweat-saturated head of hair and forehead. "Man, I bet that was exciting. You all right?" Tommy asked Mills. Mills smiled and looked back at Georgia Bell and said, "More than you know." Sadly, Mills' smile fell, and that was when Willie noticed and asked him, "What is it?" "Jack was flying with that new crew, Deuces, and they got hit over the target. They should be here if they made it back by now," Mills said. "Wait, Jack was with Deuces?" Tommy asked. "Isn't Deuces that crew that Mason's flying with?" Willie asked. "Yeah, shit, I can't believe... Are you sure?" Tommy asked Mills. "I'm sure. I watched them fall behind. They took flak to their number 4 engine, and they fell behind pretty quickly. We lost track of them when we hit the rally point," Mills said with fear drifting in his eyes. "Well, let's hope it turn up. Anyone hurt in your ship?" Willie asked. "Surprisingly, no. We took a lot of flak to our underbelly, and our right side especially. It was a miracle nobody was hit, but it shredded our hydraulic system, and we couldn't get the landing gear down. I think the mechanism was shot out too," Mills explained, taking looks back at Georgia Bell. And then, he along with the others began looking towards the horizon for any chance of Deuces returning, but they saw nothing. It had been 40 minutes since the formation had arrived back to Thurlow, and all the planes were successfully down on the ground, with the exception of dropping Deuces. Tommy and a few others stood by the control tower and waited for a few more minutes for any signs of Deuces. Tommy was sitting in the cold grass while Willie was squatting next to him, smoking his daily cigar, and did so by looking up into the sky. The sun was nearing towards the horizon behind them, and the temperature was dropping from the high of the day, which was 45 degrees, and was falling to the day's low, which was 32. Neither Tommy or Willie were saying anything. That was until Mills arrived behind them, still dressed in his flight suit. "Anything?" Mills asked, sitting down next to Tommy. "No. I know it's a slim chance they'll show, I just, you know..." Tommy began to say before Willie finished what Tommy was going to say. "Have to give it a chance?" "Yeah," Tommy said. "Nothing wrong with that. That's why I came back to join you," Mills commented as he wrapped his arm around his knees in front of him. Silence fell on the men for some time before Willie stood up and said, "Well, it's almost 17:30. It's going to be dark soon." "Just a little bit longer, Willie," Tommy said. Mills soon agreed, and Willie angled his head downward and took in a deep breath. To kill the silence, Mills asked, "Are we going out tonight?" "I don't feel like going out, to be honest," Tommy said softly. "Well, to be frank, the pub is the only place I really want to be right now," Willie added. "Well, let's see how we feel in an hour or so. As for me, if Jack doesn't return or Mason, then I say we get a drink and honor them by leaving a drink for each of them,"
Mill suggested. I guess, Tommy admitted. After a few seconds of silence, Tommy then asked, "So, what's that new kid doing?" "Being just at the mesh hall with him? Not sure if I like him yet," Willie commented. "He seems nice," Mills added. "It just seems so weird that he's replacing Al. It's like, you know, it's like," Tommy begun to say, but couldn't seem to get the words out. "Like Al's really gone?" Mills finished. "Yeah. You have a smoke?" Tommy said, looking over at Willie and Mills. "I've got your pack right here, buddy," Willie said, reaching into his pocket and pulled out of a pack of Lucky Strike cigarettes and a gold Zippo lighter. Tommy proceeded to take a cigarette out of the pack and lit it, and soon Mills did the same. Together, the three men sat in the grass in silence and kept their eyes glued to the empty horizon. Minutes later, as the men were done with the cigarette, that's when Tommy took a deep breath, accepted the fate of his comrades, and stood up to head back to the mess hall for some dinner. Mills and Willie did the same. As the man began silently walking towards Pennsylvania Avenue, they saw an ambulance and fire truck start to head towards the airfield. Tommy was utterly confused by this and looked to Willie and Mills, who were both shocked by it as well. Suddenly, looking to the northeastern end of the airfield, just above the tree line, was a sight that the men could not believe that they were seeing. The crew of Dropping Deuces had been flying on two engines for the last 3 hours. Because of this, the crew had dropped from 18,000 feet, which they had been able to maintain for some time, to 5,000 feet, and were slowly falling even further. The other two engines were close to overheating, and the plane was dangerously running low on gas. Hillhouse insisted that the crew try to land in an RAF field or an emergency field close to the coast, but Jack insisted that they could make it the extra 60 miles home. Jack looked out at the outboard number 4 engine, which had been feathered since it had been hit over the target. Looking over to his left, past Hillhouse, was their dead number 1 engine, which had been trailing black smoke from the leak in an oil tank that was caused by a flak shell fragment. The crew was beyond tired and fed up, for they had been ready to defend their plane for over 5 hours. Luckily, Hillhouse and his crew ran into a group of British Hawker Typhoons returning from a coastal attack, and the group of British planes escorted the straggling bomber to the English coast. Now, the crew of Dropping Deuces limped over the trees to the northeast end of the airfield in an attempt to make a direct landing. Jack extended the flaps, but only to 25%, and this was because Deuces needed all the airspeed that they could get in order to make it to the runway. Then, as Jack lowered the landing gear, which was successfully lowered and locked into place, he headed towards runway 2. Deuces barely grazed the top of the trees with its landing gear down, and Hillhouse held his breath and looked utterly terrified, as he couldn't believe that they hadn't hit a single treetop yet. Before he knew it, the tree line passed by, and now, the bomb and ammo dump was underneath them. Jack could see ground crewmen watching them come in.
"Flaps down,
100%, Hillhouse yelled out. Jack then extended the flaps down all the way, and soon the lumbering fortress wheels hit the tarmac, only 6 feet from the edge of the runway. The plane bounced after hitting the tarmac from their high rate of speed and extreme angle of approach, and after bouncing a few more times, finally became steady when Deuces was almost halfway down the runway. As the plane slowed down, Jack looked over towards the control tower and saw an ambulance and fire truck heading towards them. He also saw three airmen running towards them from across the airfield. Hillhouse brought Deuces almost to a complete stop towards the end of the runway, and soon, Hillhouse turned the bomber to the right and began running down the perimeter track, heading towards their squadron's hardstands. As the plane rolled down the track, they were then escorted by a jeep with a checkered flag lifted high enough for Hillhouse and Jack to see over the nose of their plane. Deuces finally arrived at their hardstand, and instead of turning the plane around to face the airfield, Hillhouse just parked the plane and cut their last two engines and called it a day. Jack didn't object. Soon, Jack jumped down from the nose hatch, following Nebo and Luther. Once down on the ground, Jack proceeded to walk over to the grass and lay down, enjoying the feeling of the cold ground underneath him. His legs and arms ached. His body felt like it had been hit by a freight train. The cold air felt good as it passed through Jack's sweat-drenched hair, since his officer's hat had fallen to the ground above his head. Within minutes, Jack heard the familiar sounds of Tommy, Mills, and Willie calling out to him. Jack looked up, saw the men running towards him, and proceeded to get up.
"You son of a bitch, is that you, Jack?"
Willie asked with a huge grin on his face. Jack nodded his head, as he too had a large smile appearing on his face. The three men arrived at Jack, and soon, the four men were standing, shining with an unbelievable amount of joy on their faces.
"Jesus Christ, what does God have to do to finish you off?" Mills sarcastically joked, giving Jack a firm handshake.
"Yeah, Tommy here was shopping all over you. You better feel warm and welcomed," Willie added.
"Is that so, Tommy?" Jack asked.
Tommy's face turned red, and even though he denied crying, he did bring Jack in for a hug. Tommy then turned around to see his friend, Mason Pointers, standing by the tail section of his plane. Tommy excused himself and proceeded to walk over to Mason, with Willie following.
"Well, how was your first mission?" Tommy asked Mason.
"Fuck me, I don't know if I can do 24 more of those," Mason said.
That's when Tommy and Willie noticed the blood stains on Mason's pants, Mae West vest, and hands.
"Everyone all right?" Tommy asked.
"No, the Nazi fucks got Cole. They got him, Tommy. They got Cole,"
Mason said as he started getting emotional. Tommy flung his arm around Mason, and the two men began walking away from the plane, Willie following behind them. Jack watched Mason walk away with Tommy, and that's when Mills asked, "Who got hit?"
"Their other waste gunner."
"God, it was horrible," Jack replied.
"Cole?"
Mills asked.
"Yeah, Cole."
"Damn.
He was a nice kid, but then again, so was Al," commented Mills, then soon realizing what he had said.
He looked back at Jack and apologized, and that's when Jack looked at Mills and said,
"Don't be. Needed to be said. Al was a good guy."
"I'll never understand why the best people die young," Mills softly said.
Jack looked back up at Mills and saw his crew member in a moment of vulnerability and said to him,
"Me too, Mills. Me too."
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content that will help to enrich the way you listen to Snafu. You will get things such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, as well as a crew member breakdown sheet that has the list of profiles and pictures of all the characters, but in order of what crew they are a part of. And along with each crew, you will get a picture of the nose art of that plane and the picture of what kind of plane, what kind of model of B-17 they are flying in. You'll also get pictures of the surrounding area, certain buildings, a pub, for instance. You'll get a map of the airfield and the surrounding area as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, and Q&A episodes if questions flood in. There's so much for you to gain just by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you would like to be a part of Snafu each week and you'd like to support this podcast, please visit our Patreon page down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping this podcast to continue. Thank you to all those who have already subscribed and are currently supporting this podcast. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Now, back to the podcast. The boss's hut was remarkably warm, as the coal furnaces had been recently fed. The boss, Rosie, Joe, Coca, O'Brien, and Sheila were silently reading letters, since this was the first time letters had arrived in Thurlow in almost 2 weeks. However,
As much as the boss was trying to focus on the letter he was holding in his hand, he couldn't keep his mind off the fact that Jack was gone. He felt sick to his stomach. His disdain for Jack all began when they first arrived at Thurlow. Jack seemed too shy, reserved, and awkward. While the boss was a socialite, he saw the military as a great way to gain connections with people from all around the world and didn't feel that Jack had the same passion as him and was even holding him back. For the most part, though, the boss was able to move past these feelings, just like he was able to look past Andy or Rosie's character quirks. But during the mission to Berlin, the boss felt that Jack was just along for the ride, and not so much learning about how to lead and how to manage a crew. He felt that his oxygen check speeches were almost scripted and not authentic. His conversations with others in the crew were bland and lacked the father or older brother nature that the boss felt a chief or co-chief of a crew should have. Then, when Jack got hit, the boss realized that if something like that happened to him, and it was left up to Jack to take control and lead the men home, that he wouldn't be able to do so. The boss subscribed to an idea that he was taught in training back in the States. That idea was, good leadership saves lives. Following protocol and leading with confidence is what helps others to perform at their best. If you're not confident, if you're not strong, if you're willing to break protocol, then your crew suffers. Men like Skimpy, in the boss's mind, reflected the weakness of men like Jack. Jack wouldn't have given Skimpy such a big responsibility and wouldn't have challenged Skimpy. But someone like the boss was willing to challenge Skimpy to go above and beyond what was expected of him. Skimpy, in the boss's mind, was not able to handle what the boss needed of him, and that was a crack in the crew of the Bull's armor. Cracks can break a plane apart and can break a crew apart. Group integrity was vital to survival and good for morale. People like Jack and Skimpy seemed like weak links in the chain that made up the group, and the boss simply wanted to fix the problem before it turned into a bigger problem. The boss's concentration and internal justification was interrupted when he heard Joe and Koga talking to one another.
"Who's that from?"
Joe asked Koga.
"The old lady,"
Koga responded. "You married Koga?" the boss asked.
"Yeah, you never knew that?"
Joe responded on Koga's behalf.
"No, I've heard you talk about Faith, but I didn't know if Faith was a sister, girl back home, or just a cousin or something,"
the boss awkwardly replied.
"Yeah, Faith is my wife. We got married back in 38,
Koga softly replied. "Any kids?" the boss asked.
"A daughter, Gloria."
"Gloria, it's a nice name," the boss complimented.
"Yeah, I thought so too. Her mother was raised Catholic, and she always wanted to have a daughter named Gloria. Good thing old Coca knows how to make a baby girl."
"How's that?" the boss asked.
"It takes a man to make a baby, but it takes a true man to knock the boss off one, you know what I'm saying?"
Coca joked. The boss cracked a forced smile and proceeded to look down at his letter. "You gotta see what she looks like. She's a doll. Show him, Koga," Sheila said, bobbing his head in the direction of the boss. The boss had no idea how to respond, because while he didn't really want to see, he didn't want to be offensive.
"Yeah, sure. Let me go ahead. Let me see a picture,"
the boss said with a sense of fake enthusiasm, which Rosie cocked a raised eyebrow in response. Koga lifted up a picture frame from his nightstand and walked over to the boss. Lifting up the picture frame to the boss's face for him to see, the boss looked up and saw a picture of a little girl dressed in a checkered dress. She had a huge smile on her face with dimples on her cheeks and a glimmer in her eye.
"Wow, she is a cutie. How old?"
the boss asked.
"Thanks. She's 5 now, but in this picture she just turned 4.
Koga proudly answered as he looked back at the photo.
"Thank you for showing me," the boss added. "Yeah. Now, you got kids?"
Koga asked as he began walking back to his bed.
"Nope. Maybe someday," the boss replied.
"Now, the real question I want to ask is, what does your old woman look like? You got a picture?"
Joe asked the boss.
A picture? The boss asked, shocked by Joe's question.
Yeah, a picture of your wife.
Do you have one? Joe repeated.
I have one right here.
The boss said, looking over to his nightstand, leaned over, grabbed a book, opened it, and pulled a small wallet-sized picture out of it. Joe, Coca, O'Brien, and Sheila all rose from their beds and walked over to the boss. Joe was the first one to arrive at the boss's bed and grab the picture.
I'd rather you not... Okay, all right, just be careful, please.
The boss said as Joe took the picture and then showed it to O'Brien, who was standing behind him.
God damn it. Man, you didn't say your wife was a literal goddess. Fuck, look at her, Joe commented.
I'd say she's got those groin eyes, Sheila commented, looking at the picture too.
The what?
O'Brien asked as he studied the picture.
You know, groin eyes. The eyes that you want looking at you when she's down there doing plumbing work on the old groin, Sheila explained.
Oh, okay now. That's just outright disrespectful. Give me the photo back, the boss said, standing up.
Okay, fine. Jesus fucking Christ, here you go.
Dear God, buddy, O'Brien said, handing the picture back to the boss. As the crew from Hailing Mary returned to their beds, the door of the hut opened, and they were stunned to see who was entering into the hut.
Jesus fucking Christ, look who it is.
What, did you annoy Hitler enough that he let you loose? O'Brien asked aloud.
It was Jack, and he cocked a smile.
The boss's face turned white as he felt like he was looking at a ghost. Rosie was also surprised as he heard from the boss not even an hour ago that Jack was gone. Rosie's eyes looked back and forth from the boss's face reaction to Jack's face reaction.
What's going on, fellas? Is my stuff gone yet?
Jack asked.
No, not yet. You're lucky for more than just that reason. What happened?
Coca asked.
It's a long story, Jack responded as he then walked over to his bed after closing the door.
We got time. We just heard that you had hit over the target, Sheila added.
Don't pester him. He's had quite the day coming back from the dead and all. Besides, I've got hot lettuce to memorize, and I don't want to miss it, Coca said.
Got it. I'll tell you guys later, but first, who needs a drink? Jack asked as he threw his stuff on his bed.
I could use one, O'Brien said.
What about you, boss?
Jack asked the boss, who was still looking stunned.
You all right?
Jack asked the boss.
The boss stood up and said,
Yeah, I just can't believe you're standing here.
Well, I'm here, so if you want to go, Jack asked, keeping eye contact with the boss.
The boss was the first one to break eye contact and said back,
Yeah, I'll be there in a bit. You guys go ahead and go.
Jack seemed confused by this, but gave the boss the benefit of the doubt by thinking that he still needed to come to grips with the fact that his buddy and crew member wasn't gone forever.
Jack nodded his head, looked over at Rosie, who was now lighting up a fresh cigarette, and asked him if he wanted to go.
As he did, Joe and the others grabbed their jackets and began heading towards the door.
No thanks. I may come up with the boss later, Rosie commented.
Jack looked at both the boss and Rosie with a look of not only confusion, but also with skepticism, since he could now tell that something was going on behind the scenes.
Okay, well, if you guys want to come up, I'll be waiting for you, Jack said.
I wonder what Parnell and the Giz guys are doing,
O'Brien asked.
I'm sure they're already up there,
Joe commented as they exited the hut with Jack following behind. As soon as the door of the hut closed, Rosie looked up and walked up to the boss and said,
You need to tell him.
Tell him what?
Don't do that. Tell him what you told me earlier.
Why?
Why?
Because he should know what you're expecting of him, Rosie fired. If he's worth his weight, he doesn't need to be told. He just needs to do his damn job.
He does his damn job. You want another chief next to you, and I'm telling you, he's not going to be doing that because we already have one in the pilot seat.
That's right. And you need to watch how you talk to your chief. I've been maybe a little too lenient with you today. I'm your chief,
and needing to watch what you say and how you say it to me," thundered the boss as he walked closer to Rosie and stood in front of him. The boss's 6'2" stature, compared to Rosie's 5'6" stature, made the boss tower over the very confident bombardier. Rosie stared up into the boss's eyes, and his brow thickened. He took a puff off his cigarette and let the smoke go between the two men. "Let's get something straight. You are, in fact, my chief, and I will follow you into hell, fighting like hell alongside you. But I will not let you do something foolish without saying something. If you'd like some quiet, spineless body to hit a fucking bomb toggle, then go find them. I don't care. I already dropped my bombs on Berlin. I can die a happy man now." The boss's face was pulsating with anger as Rosie's dramatic speech unfolded, but that soon was erased and replaced with an ornery grin. Rosie didn't know how to handle the boss's change of face and emotions, but kept his eye contact. "You know, Rosie, I strongly underestimated you." "I think you underestimate a lot of people," Rosie fired back. The boss's grin grew to a full smile, and then he said, "All right, come on, Rosie. I think you've earned yourself a scotch on the rocks, on me." Rosie stayed still and didn't move even as the boss grabbed his jacket and was getting ready to leave. As the boss opened the door, Rosie then turned around, grabbed his jacket, and proceeded to leave the hut. Thank you for listening to episode 11 of Snafu, a historical fiction podcast depicting the average life of a bomber crew in World War II. If you would like more information about the podcast, please visit our website and our Patreon page. Both links are down in the show notes. This podcast is produced by Canso 34 Studios, a DIY project helping to raise awareness to the brave young men who sacrificed their lives in the skies over Europe in World War II. I hope we do it justice. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next week for episode 12 of Snafu, The Milk Run.